The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. It's approaching 4 minutes past nine on this Thursday. We're at the 14th of May, 2025. No, 2026. How are you all keeping? I do hope you're very well indeed. I hope your day's going well so far. It's kind of a cold, blustery day out there today. And unfortunately, that's what we're facing into the weekend. But there is hope. There is hope of warmer weather in the second half of May. Anyway, some people just like this weather too. We always presume people want it blistering sun, but not everyone does. Right, anyway, that's the weather forecast. 086 60 25,000. That's the WhatsApp and the text number. 086 60 25,000. Use that number if you've never contacted us or a radio station before. We love your comments, and every single one of your comments is equal to the next. And anybody's opinion for that matter. You can also give us a call if that suits you better, 07491 25,000. Our researcher and senior producer Caroline Orr and Shannon Wilkin both waiting to take your calls. And if you want to email straight into the station here, it's comments@highlandradio.com. Let's have a look at the papers this morning. We'll start with the Tyrconnell Tribune. And as frustration grew at Tuesday's municipal district meeting over who would take responsibility for giant potholes, the Mayor of Letterkenny, Kieran Brogan, said if need be, the councillors would fill them. Councillor Jay McMonagle had raised the issue of a couple of potholes that were so wide they almost covered the width of the entrance to Port Link Business Park Road in Letterkenny. It is located off the Joe Bonner Road, which links the Neil T. Blaney to the Port Road. Similar difficulties are being experienced elsewhere as well. Area Roads Manager David McElwain told the meeting that it was a private road and therefore not the council's responsibility. Councillor McMonagle said the entrance to the road was virtually impassable. Such was the enormous size of the potholes. Portlink Business Park Road is where an iPass centre is located with 370 residents along with the Good and New Shop. Yeah, it's a nasty piece of road, that. I have been down there myself, but it's a big old pothole. It's not even a pothole. It's like a trench. But who owns the road and who's responsible for fixing it? The councillor says they'll do it themselves. We shall see. The Derry People Donegal News. Two more Donegal children have the same life-threatening condition as Lahey schoolboy Aaron Lagan and are in a race against time, health chiefs have been warned. Donegal TD Piers Doherty issued the warning to the health service executive in Dáil Éireann yesterday as he called for the children to receive a new drug that slows their terminal disease. The Donegal News last week reported how 9-year-old Aaron has the heartbreaking illness, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, an incurable condition that can lead to scoliosis, but also causes his muscles, including his heart, to slowly stop working. And we were listening to that we were obviously listening live into the Dáil yesterday, both Piers Doherty, Pat the Cope Gallagher, Senator Manus Boyle on Monday. All three of them have raised the issue. The HSE, in my sort of reading of the commentary, seemed to chuck the responsibility over to the company that provides this drug. But really what we need for those, I thought it was two families, but the paper's reporting three. But what we need for them now is some sort of a system that gets the drug to them and we can worry about the cost or reimbursement a little later on. There is no time, and hopefully we've made direct contact with the Minister for Health's offices as well. Hopefully things move quickly. Things have moved really quite quickly over the last week, I would suggest. It just needs to be gotten over the line now, and we're continuing to keep the pressure on now directly ourselves with the Minister for Health, who I believe is, if she's made properly aware of the situation and understands the situation, that she will act on it. I do believe she is that type of a person, so we shall see. The Derry News this morning. The lifelong friend of a whistleblower continually dismissed by PSNI personnel investigating the death of Kate Simpson has called for a public inquiry into the circumstances surrounding his death. Dairyman Paul Lusby repeatedly and unsuccessfully attempted to warn the PSNI Jonathan Cruel had murdered the Young Show jumper, contrary to Creswell's claims she had taken her own life. Bertie Ahern back in the papers today. He does have a history of maybe saying stuff that's controversial. One of the biggest things, of course, and I remember sitting in the audience down in Bundoran many years ago where he made some comments about suicide that proved to be very controversial. But he's got himself in a bit of hot water again. Bertie Ahern was denounced yesterday after he was secretly recorded saying he worries about the number of Africans coming into the country and the next generation of Muslims. Taoiseach Micheál Martin said Fianna Fáil did not approve of the former Taoiseach's comments made while on a canvas and which threatened to overshadow the party's Ardèche and centenary celebrations this weekend. Politicians, immigrant groups and Muslim community leaders condemned the remarks, with one branding them disturbing and offensive. After the controversy erupted, Mr. Ahern went public to say he has no problem with people who come into Ireland through the visa and asylum systems. However, the special rapporteur on racial equality and racism at the Department of Justice, Dr. Ebon Joseph, told the Irish Daily Mail it was upsetting and scary to hear. It's like comments from the 1970s. So what he had actually said was that, as I mentioned, that he was worried about the number of Africans coming into the country and the next generation of Muslims, and that's caused that furore around his comments. The Irish Times is reporting very worst case scenario, by the way. The headline is shocking. Inflation could hit 7% by the end of the year, AIB warns. They have warned that, but it's their worst case scenario if oil goes to €150 a barrel and so on and so forth. But anyway, inflation in Ireland could accelerate to 7% this year if the Strait of Hormuz remains blockaded for an extended period and oil prices increase further, AIB has warned. In its latest economic outlook, the bank said Irish economic growth would be more muted because of the lingering geopolitical uncertainty. Assuming oil prices fall back towards $85 a barrel, by the end of 2026, they are currently over 100. AIB predicted inflation here would average 4% this year. So that's much less than the 7. Still, it is an increase. And jobs growth slowing down a little bit for a year and then picking up again. Many reasons for that. We're reaching full employment, of course, and also literally full productivity. So eventually that is going to have to slow down. But interestingly, too, post-Brexit, we aren't as... Do you remember there was a time that Britain got the sniffles, we got a cold, we're really quite independent and not reliant on Britain as much as we are now, the EU and America in terms of trade and what have you. So I thought that was an interesting part of that report. But we shall see. I think one way or other, they're going to have to find a way to lower the price of oil. We saw one of the big oil producers trying to decouple from that sort of cartel of oil distributors in the Middle East. And I suspect we're going to start seeing the benefits of that in the not too distant future. I did mention Britain and the rumbling... the future over the speculation over the future of Keir Starmer rumbles on. Wes Streeting is poised to resign as British Health Secretary to force leadership election against Keir Starmer as the crisis within the Labour Party deepens. It was first revealed on Monday that Mr. Streeting was expected to launch a leadership bid as his supporters led the way in declaring no confidence in the Prime Minister. But you see, the problem they have within the Labour Party is that there are sort of left and right leaning members within that party. So there is a big cohort of MPs that would favour a left kind of a candidate. Wes Streeting is seen as more of a sort of a right leaning candidate. So it's not just as simple as someone to replace Keir Starmer. They're looking at the direction, the political direction of that party, longing to the future. So Wes Streeting is likely to gamble, but it's not a gamble he's guaranteed to win. The Irish Farmers Journal talking more about Brazilian beef. They've been doing more investigations, of course. Brazilian meat exports to the EU have officially been placed on notice after member states voted on Tuesday to strike Brazilian off a draft list of countries that will be eligible to ship meat into the EU from September. Brazil was removed from the list as the country has been deemed non-compliant with EU antimicrobial rules. The rules have applied to EU livestock farmers since 2022 and will be applicable to those exporting beef and eggs into the EU from the 3rd of September 2026. These regulations ban the use of this antimicrobials as growth promoters or to boost weight gain while also preventing the usage of medicine reserved for humans in livestock. So, of course, the Mercosur deal, big talks about that. There is Brazilian beef in the EU already. I suppose this shows, does it, that the EU rules will weed out a worse type of a product. A ban on social media for under 16s. Do you remember all the talk about this? Simon Harris said he wanted to do it and we'll decouple from the EU and go ahead and do it if we have to. Well, a ban on social media for under 16s in Ireland isn't supported by a group of TDs and senators that examined the reputation of online platforms. That's despite Media Minister Patrick O'Donovan saying he would introduce such a ban, with the support being echoed by Taoiseach Simon Harris. After Australian banned social media for under-16s and other countries began to follow suit, the OCTAS Committee on Arts, Media and Communications looked at whether Ireland should do this and other ways to make the online world safer. In a report published yesterday, members didn't recommend such a strict ban, with Chairman Alan Kelly saying it wouldn't be effective as it would be evaded fairly quickly. The Labour TD said no expert witnesses spoken to as part of the report suggested that such a restriction would be useful. So whilst it might seem like a good idea on the face of it, the implementation, how easy it would be to circumnavigate, etc., much more complicated. So that's back on the back burner again, isn't it? We welcome on to the programme Sean Doran, Artistic Director and Founder of Arts Over the Budget, Over the Border Ireland. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Greg.
Great to chat to you. And I suppose, you know, by any metric, the Wild Atlantic Way has been a huge success. Now, we could debate, if the northern half of the Wild Atlantic Way benefits as much as the southern half and what could be done to address that. But anyway, be that as it may, still, it has proven a great success across its entire run. Now, you're of the view that we could do something similar with the arts. In fact, that's the plan, yeah?
Well, it is. I mean, we as a company have been working in the Northwest now for the last 10 years, particularly with the Brian Friel Festival and Samuel Beckett and Oscar Wilde in Enniskillen and Fermanagh. And we had mapped out before we began implementing events about, must be nearly 15 years ago, this constellation of A-lister writers, Irish writers, that have northerly associations, and particularly if you look at the border and the five northern border counties in Northern Ireland and the six southern in the Republic of Ireland coming together, where the border is a binder, you have this marvellous sweep from the Tyne and the East Coast and C.S. Lewis and Narnia and St. Patrick Confessio right through to our most contemporary literary greats of Brian Friel and Seamus Heaney and Donegal and Derry. Now, that's very simplistically putting, you know, major foundational writers there, and we've created maps on that basis, and we're working at this moment on a map of living writers that is much more diverse, particularly in gender and ethnicity. And I suppose the bottom line is, from my sort of distant background of having co-authored the original Rough Guide to Ireland at the end of the 1980s, is to look at that line between Galway and Dublin and how to keep lifting it northerly, that tourists, the broad span of tourists, start shifting upwards to what they probably have neglected historically. And this is one driver to attract them to do these nine literary ways.
And, you know, if you were into that type of thing, how attractive might it be, you know, to either be able to visit where your favourite author or one of your favourite author or artists lived or was reared, or to be able to sort of stand looking at something that inspired them to write one of your favourite pieces of work. It would be very attractive. And there's, you know, what, 7 or 8 billion people on this planet. That's a big old market to potentially be able to tap into.
It is. I mean, it's a niche literary tourism there, but they're anorak.
Well, so is. So's lighthouses. But it's huge.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And it brings a different type of tourist, you know, if it spots that sort of rationale of why to go to somewhere. And then, of course, you get the wealth of the beauty of the landscape, the people and all other things along with it. But it's one added layer I think, to offer these 11 counties, you know, in the northern part of Ireland. It's quite unique, and we're seeking UNESCO status for it, which is a kind of validation of its worth. When you get that, UNESCO initiated about 25 years ago the beginnings of cities, UNESCO cities of literature across the world, of which there are now 60. Dublin is one, of course, and Edinburgh and Norwich and Britain are two others, but it goes right through to Brazil and Poland. So this will be seeking that this region becomes a UNESCO region of literature.
Mm. So I'm actually looking at a map where nine literary ways have been drafted. So it's there, the information is there. What needs to be done? I mean, obviously you talked about UNESCO recognition, which would be, of course, huge. But what needs to be done from here then? You know, that maybe we could see some level of success like we did see with the Wild Atlantic Way.
Yeah, and with the Wild Atlantic Way, whoever's, I know it was through Falter Ireland, simple concept that was of just pulling together what already exists, but giving it a very sharp sort of brand has worked, as you say, more southerly than northerly. But, you know, in time, these things build and build. The idea here is not dissimilar in the sense of it has to be a shared enterprise. It's not one Arts Over Borders is just pushing the boat out on this, putting the map out on it. We will create networks between the literary fraternities of, well, there's now three literary centres, the Seamus Heaney in Derry and Patrick Kavanagh, most recently renovated in the last years in Skeen, and of course the Brian Friel Centre in Donegal. Mm-hmm. A number of these routes, the Northwest Dramatic Way, takes in Derry and Frank McGuinness and Buncrana and Friel and Glenties and so on, and the Singer-Songwriters Way, which is one of the nine as well, of course, takes in Daniel Donald, Clannad and Derry, and they somehow seem to have fallen into routeways that are very amenable for a visitor within a day to actually travel through any one of them or pick up and mix them. But yeah, it is only going to work if it is something that sort of reaches a tipping point of others buying into it. So, for example, in Buncrana, you would have no evidencing of Frank McGuinness's connection with it. So whereas in Derry, with Lisa McGee and Derry Girls, there's the mural, there's the exhibition in the visitor centre and so on. And there's strong visuals evident there. So in some places, what we would hope would happen now is that the initiative would be taken to join in on this route. And then you have more to see when you actually travel to an individual town or village.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, using the Wild Atlantic Way as an example, when it was formed or originally drafted, and it became like something that this is definitely going to happen, all of a sudden the conversation started, well, why is in a show not in it? Could it be extended into Derry? And sometimes I think you're not going to get something perfect prior to its launch, but you get it very close to it, and then obviously it can grow and expand, and people say, "I want a slice of that pie." You know,
yes.
Interesting. Okay,
and you get in the border. Then also, I mean, because the border is in at the center of this one, but it kind of turns it on its head, saying the border can actually symbolically act as a binder. You know, it's like a river that runs through this region. Now, this is obviously a very creative, visionary way of looking at it, but exactly as you're pointing out, things stop at the border, such as the Wild Atlantic Way, and then the Causeway route takes over, and there should be a sense of coming together under the
of course rock. Because if you are coming from we can perhaps understand the illogical nature of it, but if you are coming from Middle America, it makes absolutely zero sense whatsoever. If people want to sort of check out what's been drafted there already, Sean, where can they go?
Well, at this early...
it's too early.
Baby step, exactly. So they can go to the Arts Over Borders website and they can see the maps there as visuals. And I'm already getting feedback from the article in the Irish Times yesterday and the conversations like this of which is exactly what we want, to saying, hold on, you missed out so-and-so. Hold on, this could connect
100%,
with that.
Yeah.
So we're going to revise and refine these maps, and I myself am committing to, and I've started the research to write a kind of rough guide, an independent guide.
I mean, I'm listening to you intently, but at the same, I mean, there's a massive mural going up in Derry in the not too distant future for the lead singer of Dream, for an example. So, you know, to mark his 50 years or something along. So, you know, everywhere you look, and that's contemporary, right? So everywhere you look, there's little things that would be of interest to people. And, of course, this is ripe, you would imagine, for cross-border sort of peace funding as well. So,
well, you'd love to think so. If that could be fine to build it more concretely, let's say. Yeah. And as you say about the Dereem and Derry, the same has happened in Enniskillen. Murals of Beckett and Wilde have gone up, and there's 150 little golden swallows there mapping out the Happy Prince story. So if one town or village looks at another, you can, of your own volition, make something happen. But we, borders, and I personally will do our bit, and hopefully over years to come you'll see that it actually builds and builds.
For sure, it's a solid start point, Sean. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Look after yourself. Sean Doran, Artistic Director and Founder of Arts Over Borders Ireland. Check out that. It's as I say, it's just another little type, not little, it's another type of tourism that might... bring even more people into us. Bertie Hearn says, a listener only said what the rest of the country is thinking. Yeah, that's often what you might hear indeed. And I'm not conflating Bertie Hearn with Reform, don't get me wrong, but the reason Reform has been so successful in Britain, whether they can deliver it or not, is because they have said what, in inverted commas, a lot of people are thinking, and they've turned that into election success. Another one on Bertie Ahern here. Ahern, the most questionable, greedy... Well, I can't read that. Not while he's alive, anyway. But anyway, they're not a big fan of his, but they go on to conclude like anyone would listen to him. Bertie Ahern, says a listener, hasn't said anything wrong, only what thousands are thinking. All asylum seekers that have entered illegally via the UK, NI, Europe, no trace footprint, the systemic breakdown of Irishness, the national fabric of what Ireland is about being torn away, the canvassers at his door should be prosecuted for entrapment, not disclosing to him they were covertly filming. The systemic breakdown of Irishness, I think, is fear porn, really. I don't even know what that truly means. I mean, we've just been talking there about establishing new ways to talk about Ireland's rich culture, its heritage, and we do this stuff all of the time, and there's an awful lot of that going on. You know, and just be proud to be Irish and celebrate your Irishness, and no one's going to take that. From you. I don't think. Bertie Ahern said what the silent majority of people have been thinking, and proof of it was well displayed yesterday on social media. The government and elements of the opposition are out of touch with the electorate on the issue. Time we had a referendum on immigration control like Poland had. Well, you see, you can do that. It's about enforcement, right? So Britain had a referendum of sorts on immigration. It was Brexit. And immigration hasn't changed at all there. So I wonder if the present-day members of Fianna Fáil who moved to distance the party from the remarks of Bertie Ahern actually privately agree with what he said, asks a listener. We were talking about the social media ban there. A ban makes no sense. The entire problem with social media is algorithmic-generated content, and that's harmful for everyone, not just kids. We need to ban algorithmic feeds and end infinite scrolling. A caller says, Greg, do you think that the rise in racism in Ireland lies at the foot of the government? Well, I think we could have a debate on the rise of racism in Ireland. I'm not sure there is. I don't believe there's a rise in racism in Ireland. I believe that we live in a world now where people feel that they can say more what they feel. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I think just people with free speech and the platforms that they have and the fact that they can express themselves anonymously. And let's face it, the majority, overwhelming majority of it is anonymous. You know, I've seen people say things that you could class as racist on social media. They've been completely piled on and I've never mentioned anything like that again. So is racism on the increase, or is it that there are certain people and with anonymity, they feel they're more empowered to say what they feel? But anyway, this caller says, I don't think this campaign against non-Irish existed prior to the influx of immigrants and the perceived benefits they receive over Irish citizens. People of this mindset are in the minority, but they are a dangerous group who mostly use the anonymity of keyboards to spew their hate, is the view of one listener. Rescams, banks are far better at reimbursing you than Revolut. There is small print there that Revolut won't reimburse. Yeah, it's I mean, they will kind, they're very hard to work with. They can be very hard to work with, but banks do have, the big banks, the pillar banks, if you are the victim of a scam like I was, if you don't receive goods, they can sort of reverse payments or compensate you. So, yeah, I think you have a point there. I'm joined on the programme now by Genevieve McGurk, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Institute of Professional Auctioneers and Valuers, IPAV. Good morning to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Craig.
It's great to have you on in the programme. We've heard from Revenue that homeowners who build modular homes in their back garden will be liable to pay a separate local property tax on that home. So just in case anyone has missed, what are we being allowed to do in terms of modular homes, Genevieve?
Yeah, so I suppose what the proposal is it's being discussed at the moment, and they're hoping to bring it in into exempting modular homes from planning permission, and they hope to bring that in before the summer recess in the Dáil. So it would mean that you would be able to build a modular home up to 45 square metres without planning permission, but it will need to be within building regulations.
And in terms of how much garden you require or any other, is it clear what the finer details of that might be?
Yes, well, we are still waiting on details in relation to the regulation behind it, but you will need to leave 25 square metres of a garden. So, as I said, if you have your 45 square metre modular home, you will need to have 25 square metres left of your garden.
Okay, and it's no surprise, is it really, that I suppose Revenue was saying we need to make sure that whatever is introduced, you know, we get an LPT if it's liable for one. We want it to be liable for one. It's not a great surprise.
No, I mean, it is in the current Finance Local Property Tax Act at the moment. It has been there already, I suppose, because this is going to be exempt from planning permission. It's come to light a little bit more. There wouldn't be that many people that would currently have modular homes in their residential home. So I suppose because this is a topic of conversation, it's come up, but it isn't anything new. And just to be clear, it does exclude structures that aren't permanently attached to the ground, in case people are concerned, you know, if they have glass houses or things like that, they're obviously not necessarily attached to the ground. It needs to be a property that's suitable for a dwelling, you know, that one can live in.
Is it clear at the moment if I sort of go, okay, this is handy, I'm going to take out a loan and build one of these, Airbnb all the way?
Well, I mean, it's not going to be that straightforward. First of all, a modular home within building regulations will cost in the region of €100,000. Mm. This isn't going to be for everybody, and it's unlikely that one will get a mortgage on it. So it may be that they're using funds that they have in a bank and topping it up with a personal loan, which obviously has a cost to people. So it's not going to be open to everybody. Mm. And it will have to be done within building regulations. It's not a matter of putting in, as they're saying, a garden shed. There has to be regulations around it. And that's why, you know, a proper modular home will be in the region of €100,000. You can get smaller modular properties, but they wouldn't necessarily be to building standards for much cheaper, and you won't be able to put those in.
So when built to building standards, you know, like people might prop one up on sticks or stones to try and prevent, you know, to try and avoid the cost of an expensive concrete base, for an example, or sinking sewer pipes or what have you. When something's not subject to planning permission, how do you control that sort of maybe type of corner cutting on what's the right thing to do?
Yeah, well, I suppose this is what we're waiting for, to be honest with you, Greg. The devil will be in the detail, and this is the detail that we're waiting for government to come back with. How are they going to manage monitoring building regulations? Will somebody have to issue a notice or send in a certificate of compliance to make sure that it is within building regulations? But we're waiting on that detail at the moment.
Yeah, and that could extend to fire alarms.
Absolutely.
Carbon monoxide, yeah. Alarms. farms, exits, all that type of stuff. It could be.
Yeah.
It's funny,
yeah,
as you edge closer to something, Genevieve, it starts to become more complicated, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it's definitely not something that you're going to throw up when you have building regulations. You're going to have to connect to water supply, electricity supply. You know, it is a significant build, but for some people, you know, it may be very beneficial. We have 69% of 25-year-olds still living at home, according to the CSO. So in some cases, It will help people, but this is one very, very small suite of measures in a much bigger requirement for the supply of property. Infrastructure and planning are the crucial piece that we need for a supply of property.
Yeah, and just to pick upon something you said earlier, you know, you quite rightly talk about the people that would struggle to get a house in another situation. But is this not going to benefit, you know, maybe mums and dads who have a few quid in the bank and are prepared to finance this to get, you know, a 28-year-old out of the house, for an example, and those who you said they're unlikely to be mortgageable. So, you know, who really is going to be the beneficiary of this? It's going to be people, you know, with a bit of a reserve to begin with, by the sounds of things, unless the credit union decide to throw their hat into the ring or whatever might happen.
Yeah, well, I do believe it is going to be people that have some reserves. I mean, we know that there is a lot of money lodged in the bank at the moment. Who has that? I'm not sure, but
it's a very interesting question. 340 billion. I think it's
that's right. Yeah. Exactly. So, I mean, some people do have finance, and the return obviously is going to be a lot better if you're renting it, for example, because it's tax free up to €14,000. So return will be a lot better than having your money at the bank. But that doesn't mean to say that you want to modular home in your garden. It's not for everybody. It's very subjective. Not everybody will want to modular home in their garden. But definitely, I think if you had an elderly parent and they wanted their independence, but you'd like them to be close by, it could be very beneficial
for something like that. Your granny flat, in inverted commas. Mm-hmm. And finally, why are these properties not mortgageable? Because if they're built to a certain standard, they're on a decent site. I suppose really it's that they're on another property's land. I can sort of see the complications as I'm asking the question. But generally speaking, why wouldn't they be mortgageable?
Well, this is a little bit outside my remit, to be honest with you, but they wouldn't have a separate folio number.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking,
so,
yeah.
I mean, from a title point of view, I would imagine it's that's going to be the biggest issue.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Listen, interesting times ahead. We'll see. The devil, as you say, as always, it's in that blooming detail, isn't it? But for now, Genevieve, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Greg.
Okay, look after yourself. Bye-bye. That's Genevieve McGurk there, Chief Executive Officer of the Institute of Professional Auctioneers and Valuers. And maybe, I suppose, if you were to, I don't know how that's, I just think on the face of it, it seems like a good idea, but I'm thinking now, who has that 100 grand? And I think 100 grand's reasonable, you know, because you can get some nice two-bed, one-bed ones, but, you know, you put your concrete base in, which you really would need, then you have to get your sewers into the septic tank. Now, if that septic tank is deemed to be able to take that sewer, a connection to the mains, I don't think you'd be able to, would you, just be able to tee off at the house or run a cable from the fuse box, you know, and all that stuff costs money. So it'll be interesting to see who actually benefits from such an initiative. Do you have a say in relation to that? Let us know. 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000, or give us a call at 074 91 25000.
Where the conversation starts, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Moving on, we're joined on the programme now by Minister of State for the Circular Economy, Minister Alan Dillon. Good morning, Minister. Thank you for your time, as always.
Good morning, Greg.
Now, as you can imagine, with our programme, and I'm sure it's similar right across the country, dog fouling in general, is one of the key annoyances for the population, and things are going to get tougher, it would seem, for those who are responsible for this activity.
Well, you're actually right, Greg, and it's a real frustration, and that's what I'm hearing from people right across the country. People are just fed up with litter, with dog fouling, with illegal dumping, and we see it in our town centres, we see it on rural roads, And they're right to be frustrated because it affects how our communities look. We have a real pride of place, and we have so many volunteers and so many organisations like the Tidy Towns who go week in, week out picking up litter, which they shouldn't have to do, but they have to, and they do it because they have huge respect for their community. And I think it impacts our public health, but it also costs local authorities significant money every year to clean it up. And that's money that could be spent elsewhere. And I want to say clearly, you know, we're not, I suppose, immune to the problem. It's there. But what we're doing is we're stepping up our response in a serious and practical way. So we'll see from the 1st of September, we're increasing the on-the-spot fines from €150 to €250. And that's important to say that those fines haven't changed since 2007. So nearly 20 years later, this is about making sure that the penalty actually reflects the seriousness of the issue today. But also, it's not just about fines. We're also putting €3 million into the anti-dumping initiatives for 2026. And that builds on over €26 million that's already invested, which has delivered over 2,200 projects and removed over 26,000 tonnes of illegal dump waste. So we're looking at this in a fully automated approach. That's around enforcement. It's around prevention, awareness, having the infrastructure and the community support. And that's all working together to deliver a cleaner, safer communities, including those right across Donegal.
I don't think we can appeal to people's better judgment anymore or rely on that to reduce the problem. There's so much education, so much conversation, so much public backlash. The last time we saw a similar initiative in terms of a major increase in fines, the last time I can recall, would be, say, for instance, the abuse of disabled parking bays. But people would have known that it's likely a parking attendant may walk past and spot them and issue a fine, and of course then they'd be subject to the bigger fine. The issue is actually enforcement, and you know how low that enforcement is. In Donegal, no enforcement at all, at least no enforcement in terms of the issuing of fines in relation to dog fouling. So if people don't feel they're likely to be caught and likely to face this increased fine, how does that change the behaviour without increased enforcement?
Well, I think you've actually highlighted the challenge that we need to address. And as you said, if you look at the figures over the last number of years, 48 fines again, 35 and then zero. But in reality, it doesn't reflect what people are seeing on the ground. And I think that tells us something very clearly. Either we're not detecting enough offences or enforcement needs to be strengthened. And that's why we need to continue to invest in enforcement staff. We're allocating over €7.7 million this year. We're supporting enhanced detection with CCTV and drone technology. We're also funding targeted work in known dumping areas. So this is about making sure people are caught and that there's actual real consequences. And while we see low numbers of fines, that doesn't mean that there's no problem. It means that the system needs to become stronger. So local authorities who are responsible in law for the enforcement piece, they decide where to inspect, how to enforce, and when to prosecute. And my job as Minister for within the circular economy is to make sure that they have the resources, the tools and the backing to do that effectively. And that's why we're stepping up this announcement today. But also we're investing a huge amount of money in regards to the response that's needed right across the country. And we've put in the likes of the CCTV and drone technology. And, you know, for many places in Donegal, a lot of illegal dumping happens in isolated places, particularly in rural areas where people believe they won't get caught. But now Donegal County Council can target known dumping black spots. They can use CCTVs where it's most effective. Also, drone technology gives them the advantage to reach hard-to-reach areas. And most importantly, they can gather proper evidence. And I think better evidence means stronger enforcement. It means real consequences. And indeed, if you combine that with the anti-dumping initiatives that we've rolled out in communities, the examples being you know, bulky waste collections around mattresses, around furniture, large items. It is making a difference, and we need to continue that progress and that momentum. And in many cases, it's not just the one approach with fines, it's also the enforcement and the public awareness and the campaigns that we're running in tandem.
Yes, and I think what you're announcing today, very effective, or has the potential, should I say, to be very effective in terms of, you know, targeting littering, black spots and all that type of stuff. I don't want to fixate on dog fouling, but just to return to that, is it time maybe local authorities had some sort of KPIs in this area, some, you know, demonstrable enforcement? As I say, we can really perhaps work on the dumping on ground, if you know what I mean, black bags, mattresses and all the stuff that you mentioned there. But we're going to hear about, you know, 9 to 5 working hours for people who might be responsible for the dog fouling side of things, no one available at the weekends. Like, is it not time, especially when you've got Vision Ireland on the other line, probably Minister Dillon, highlighting all the disgusting experiences of their members that they're trying to get rid of? Do we need to sort of try and find a bar or encourage local authorities to do more specifically with the dog fouling, just whilst to have you?
Yeah, and certainly I hear that, and I accept that more can be done. And certainly I will ask my officials again to examine how we can better support local authorities with additional support, more staff, but also better use of technology. And I know in Dublin, Dunleary Rathdown County Council, it was brought forward by one of their members, Councillor Pearce Dargan, in regards to the use of DNA testing for dog fouling. And I think that would be a use of technology to bring forward real consequences in regards to leftover dog fouling that can be linked to a dog license.
Yeah, and just in relation to that, we could end up then with perhaps a more robust understanding of what dogs are out there and who owns them. And I would say your colleagues in the agricultural department who have farmers complaining about sheep kills or sheep worrying, you know, would be very interested perhaps in working with you on that, because we could potentially address two problems at the one time.
Yes, and that's certainly something that I'm very committed to exploring. There is a multifaceted approach to this. The Department of Rural and Community Development look after the dog licensing piece. I look after the enforcement, the supports for anti-dumping initiatives, and we will look to see how we could pilot something like this. It is in place in North Italy, and certainly if you look at the amount of dog owners across the country, it would have a significant element of deterring people in public parks, in streets and public areas to ensure that they remove any dog fouling that may lead to enforcement or consequences down the line. So certainly it would have an added advantage. And certainly, you know, it is really important to emphasise that, you know, communities play a huge part in this. And we've seen, you know, national spring cleans. We've seen other areas in terms of how we can continue to educate people, you know, to ensure that they have better habits, that behaviours start to change. Because I think you can see that clearly, you know, in regards to other schemes that we've introduced in making our communities cleaner, more litter free. And again, these initiatives are really important to ensure that the taxpayer isn't paying the millions of euros every year to deal with littering and dumping. And I think the vast majority of people want to do the right thing, and they shouldn't have to pay for those who don't. And I think increasing the fines is one part of that. The enforcement piece is really important. And I think over the next number of months and years, that's something I'm very much committed to stepping up.
Yeah, indeed. And people listening who are inclined to dump, take note. Hopefully, if all goes to plan, that secret hideaway or that private road or whatever it might be where you're dumping, don't believe there aren't eyes on you, because the technology and the enforcement hopefully is there, but is going to be ramped up into the future.
Yes, for sure. And, you know, because it, as I said earlier, it's not the one measure. It's a full approach. It's stronger fines, you know, more funded enforcement, CCTV and drones, real projects in our communities, better community engagement, because, you know, your listeners take real pride in where they live. They want their clean towns, clean roads. They want respect for their communities. And indeed, government needs to back that with real funding, with enforcement, with action. But it also comes down, again, to personal responsibility.
For sure.
And that's how we deliver real change.
OK, Minister Alan Dillon, Minister of State for the Circular Economy, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Greg.
On dog fouling, I read that one. People are saying you need enforcement. Quite true, quite true. Dumping. I have a neighbour and the back of the house is terrible with rubbish and rats. Is there a fine for that? Well, I'm not really quite sure. Is it a private house? Is it a council house? I don't know what. That's kind of like a question for Seamus Gunn, I would think. Legally, what can you do? Horrible situation to be living beside, because you know if those rats are in their garden, they're not recognising boundaries, are they? On the issue of property tax, two houses were built in gardens of houses near myself recently in the Letterkenny area. I myself was refused the same over 10 years ago in a much bigger garden site for a smaller dwelling. Now they're talking about making it legal. Another, that's what I've always dreamed of, living in a glorified shed. Thank God they've relaxed the building regs for us plebs just after hearing the tax relief for renting of up to 14,000. This is crazy how everything about our economy is skewed in favour of the asset-owning class. Rent out the shed to keep the children working, my God, they say. Another, people who build in the parents' property, the government are coming after them for more property tax. Scandalous behaviour by this government. On the issue of Bertie Ahern, is this the same Bertie Ahern that bankrupt the country over 50 million alone on voting systems that has only been used by spiders, not to mention millions on tribunals and bailouts for everyone in the audience? Yeah, indeed. And that 50 million, if you were to scale that, in for inflation now, it really might be quite interesting. Right, I have in front of me Paula Leonard. Paul Leonard, they've put down here. I presume they've dropped an A, Paula, have they?
I presume so, yes. Okay, my father would have been proud.
Okay. Paula Leonard, who's CEO of Alcohol Forum Ireland. And you are seeking, of course, and you have been seeking to make the Letterkenny, the county, the country, a better place in terms of our relationship with alcohol, I suppose, generally. And there's a documentary coming up focusing specifically on Letterkenny, if I'm correct. Tell me a little bit about this, Paula.
Okay. No, it doesn't actually focus on Letterkenny. It's a global documentary.
Can I just say one thing? You walked in whilst I was speaking, and I was a little thrown by that. Building Safe for Letterkenny is bringing the documentary.
Indeed, it
is. Masking Influence. Okay, go ahead.
Yes. So last year I was involved in the making of a documentary with global partners, actually, from Africa, Asia, Australia, and here in Europe, that really was taking a step back. And it's not just actually about the alcohol industry. It's about numbers of health-harming industries. Mm-hmm. So from pesticides to food, ultra-processed foods, to actually digital drivers of ill health and the alcohol industry, tobacco industry.
Yeah, and this is something we have both referenced in the past in terms of the influence of these industries over policy. And as you say, it's not just the physical. You could chuck in the gambling industry in there as well, I'm sure.
Absolutely, and I suppose for me, the beauty of the film we're showing tonight in Letterkenny Library, and big shout out to them for hosting, the film that we're showing tonight really allows people to take a step back and say, well, actually, maybe this isn't anything to do with the products. You know, this isn't about alcohol as a product and as a drink. It's actually about the alcohol industry that's driving up rapid increases in alcohol-related deaths right across the world. And Europe is, you know, the highest drinking region of the world. We drink more alcohol than anywhere else. We have a really well-established and entrenched sort of alcohol industry that influences policy at the European level, at the global level, and here in Ireland at this level. So, you know, for example, back in 2018, the year the Irish government was debating whether or not it would bring forward the Public Health Alcohol Act, we had lobbyists from the alcohol industry in the houses of the Oireachtas more often than every day. Do you know what I mean? So they were there more times than once a day. So we know that they try and exert pressure. But I think the thing about Unmasking Influence is it allows you to see that this isn't unique to the alcohol industry. So alcohol harm is what I spend most of my time worrying about and working on. But in fact, they're using the same tactics across all of those industries. So we're looking at influencing research, undermining researchers and scientific evidence, influencing politicians, influencing policy, and using very significant resources to do that. So we see them, you know, lobbying the World Health Organization to remove the harmful, you know, remove a statement, clear statement that alcohol, that there's no safe level of alcohol. So they want them to take that out of their global policies. The WHO have to sort of stand up to that on a daily basis. You know, the same thing happened at the European level when the World Health Organization European office was bringing forward their legislation on the European Framework Convention on alcohol. So we see this all of the time. And, you know, repeatedly in pesticides, in fossil fuels, in alcohol, in food, we really don't see the sort of invisible harm that these industries are doing.
And, you know, people listening, there might be those that go, there might be those that are listening going, thank God, we need to do more about this. These, you know, this is crazy what's going on. Then there might be others that go, well, you know what, this is nanny state, you know, we can do whatever we want. We know what's best for us. All of those people are just a commodity to these people.
Absolutely.
It really doesn't matter. So if you think that you're, if you think that, you know, that you could bat for these organisations, they are quite literally putting profits before people. And OK, maybe you might say about restrictions to alcohol, the cost of alcohol, that's fine. But let's have a conversation about vaping. Let's have a conversation about pesticides. Let's have a conversation about baby food. You know what I mean? And it's all to them. It's all the same. And we are there to be exploited, whether you agree or disagree with what Paul is saying.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you've mentioned baby food. I think tonight, after the after tonight's showing of the film, which is only 58 minutes long, there'll be a questions and answers session. And one of the people at that is Dr. Sarah Brennan, who lives here in the county, but who is actually the chairperson nationally of the baby feeding law group in Ireland. And at the moment, globally, you've seen recalls of baby infant formula, governments not standing up to that, governments not regulating for that, allowing sort of those levels of influence to go unregulated and those harms to go unmitigated. So I think the thing that you're talking about, you know, maybe it's nothing to do with me. One of the greatest successes of those big corporations is that they've allowed us to believe that we're living with choice and that public health advocates are somehow harming our
Can I give maybe, and correct me if I'm wrong, an example of choice sticking with baby formula? It's how it's advertised. It's how it looks. It's how it's targeted for babies that might be 1 to 3 months old, but there's a big plump 8 month old baby on the tin. You know, they've been called out for that in the past. I'm not sure if that's been addressed, but you know, it's the very subtle stuff for how they influence us. And then it's the more obvious sort of, you know, way more harmful ways they can do. But it's happening on many levels all the while. People sit watching the sport now and you'll see a massive, massive Guinness sign on the pitch. And then you'll see a little 0.0 to the right. OK, they're advertising their booze. Obviously, they're advertising the alcohol free stuff. But look, you see the big, massive Guinness, you see the tiny little 0.0. Again, I'm not calling them out on it, but this is how they're trying to circumnavigate what's going on there to try and ensure that you continue to take their product, which is carcinogenic, whether we like it or not.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, the notion that we are choosing behaviours and choosing to take and consume products that are harmful to us is really something that needs to be held up to examination, because it's nothing to do with our personal choices. It's to do with failures of governments and states to regulate these harmful products. So we're seeing epidemics in obesity, in smoke, you know, in smoking-related illnesses, in alcohol-related illnesses, in early deaths right across the globe that are being caused in the main by these really powerful, very well-resourced industries. And governments, I mean, by 2016, there was a report done by Global Justice Now that said of the 100 list of the biggest economic entities in the world, that of those, only 31 at that stage were governments. And on the top 10, only one of those was governments, being the US. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing the emergence of the billionaire class that has been supported by tax systems.
Yes,
we're not questioning, you know, the the impact that that's having on our democracy.
But people can still have a choice.
Absolutely.
But they can have a choice with all of the facts.
Yeah.
So, in other words, it's an informed choice. And everyone should want that. So, yeah. You know, if something is harmful to your baby or if something is harmful to you, you know, you can have your free will and you can still make that choice, providing it wasn't outlawed or banned or what have you. But what the companies try and do is ensure that your choice is not actually an informed choice.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, the thing is, I mean, people say to me, you know, should we drink alcohol? And I always say, well, actually, that's not my business. That's not my choice to make. That's up to you. But what I would like you to know is that this is a carcinogenic, that there's no safe level of it, that it should never be consumed during pregnancy, that teenagers should never be exposed to it because their brains haven't developed and it's neurotoxic and it disrupts that development. So these are just the things that people should know, that they should be allowed to
know.
But
people don't want to hear that even.
No,
some people,
they don't.
You know, willful ignorance is a thing as well, right?
Yeah.
And I am sure, I certainly know I employ that. I'm sure there's probably areas of your life that you do as well. But, you know, we sometimes don't want the facts either. But that plays into these massive, massive companies. It's very, this is a global film. It's very interesting to see Ireland and Donegal featured through yourself. Mm-hmm. You're focusing, are you, on the alcohol industry? Or
I am indeed in the film, yeah. There are advocates from across the world.
You really are a spoil sport.
I'm a terrible spoil sport, the party police, really. But, you know, I think it's wonderful, actually, to see a small organisation that started Ireland,
it's very impressive.
You know, being part of these global conversations. And I mean, I had the absolute privilege a number of weeks ago of presenting in relation to some of the work that we're doing at the Global Alcohol Policy Conference. And it's really interesting in those spaces to talk to people from low and middle income countries, because, yes, we have issues around regulation of these products. We've issues here about the advertising of these products. But we do have the Public Health Alcohol Act. We do have, you know, committed people working to protect Irish citizens from this. And in low and middle income countries, you're seeing that an awful lot of these industries, particularly around pesticides, baby infant formula, alcohol, you know, they are acting in areas where there's very light touch regulation, where there isn't resources for sort of the safety net of health systems that we have here. So, you know, we can't really work on these issues in isolation in our own little country, because the drivers of harm are global and the solutions must be global.
Yeah, but we've also demonstrated that we can lead out on things as well. Right, so the film is obviously available. It's obviously going to be shown tonight, followed by a Q&A. Are there still spaces available? I know you want people to book via email, francis@alcoholforum.org, to have an idea of numbers. Are there still opportunities?
There are still seats available. So we know plenty of people have booked already. We're really looking forward to it. But I think, you know, if it's on tonight, there's still some seats available. Just show up to the library at 5:30. And can I come to something totally different, Greg, that I just wanted to mention, is tomorrow we have a big golf classic on in the Ballybuffet Stranorler Golf Club. So it's part of our fundraising drive. And the reason we need to fundraise is because we want to do more.
Yeah.
Because the problems are getting bigger, the issues are getting bigger, the number of families coming to us in crisis are increasing all of the time. And it's important for us to fundraise. So Ballybuffet Stranorler, the two wonderful women, Anne and Dolores there, have been organising this for me in the background.
So is it what, teams of four?
It's teams of four. I have never played golf in my life, so I'm going to wander into something I'm not so sure what I'm talking about. It's a four-ball stable forward, I think. And, you know, two of our board, Dr. Paul Armstrong, who's our chairperson, and Pat Harvey, who's on our strategic planning committee, are golfers. Yeah. They do know what they're talking about, but
so
I'm in the
Ballybuffet
Stranorler
tomorrow. Of course, the scorecards operation. It's a good opportunity for you golfers out there to play maybe a parkland course or something if you're used to playing on links, or just to get out and play something different, but in support, a good cause. And because it's later in the day too, I presume there's some later tea times as well.
There are.
Contact the golf course?
You contact the golf course directly, but really, I suppose, for us, it will raise vital funds as part of our drive for the Northwest NK.
Sure.
And I do want to thank Kingsbridge Private Hospital Northwest, who's come on board as the main sponsor. We've fabulous prizes from golf courses right across this county, where I believe we've some of the best golf courses in the world. And there's fabulous prizes for anyone who goes out to play. But the main sponsors, having Kingsbridge there is great because it means that it increases the amount of money then that we bring back into the charities.
100%. Paula Leonard, thank you for joining us as always. Well done. CEO of Alcohol Forum Ireland. We actually got a text into the programme saying, why is there nothing on the news about the outbreak of the virus on another cruise ship that sailed from Belfast last week? Over 50 known cases on the ship and one death without any prior symptoms. Well, there is some coverage of it. So there is one major cruise ship currently docked in the centre of Bordeaux, but it's making headlines for more than just its view. It is because there is an outbreak of the norovirus on it. Eileen is a listener to this show and this radio station and joins us. Hi, Eileen.
Hiya.
You are in Bordeaux at the moment. So last Friday, you I'm not sure if you're a regular cruiser or is this a trip of a lifetime, but you got on the boat in Belfast on...
Yes, my third cruise, actually. Okay. But the first on this ship.
And there's a number of you from the Guidor area on the ship, isn't there?
There are four of us that I know of. Four, yeah.
Now, of course, there's talk of a virus, a different type of virus on another ship. This is norovirus. Unfortunately, an elderly gentleman has already succumbed to it. What is the... There's 50 known cases on the ship. What's happening there from your perspective now? Are you able to move freely on board the ship?
Yeah, we are, and we're allowed. Restrictions have been lifted. We're able to go ashore today.
Okay, and what was it like up until now? Were the restrictions before today, Eileen?
Well, nothing except yesterday where we weren't allowed to leave the ship. Otherwise, everything was normal.
Okay, so when hear from a listener saying, you know, why is no one talking about this? Is it because everyone was very calm and relaxed on the ship and enjoying their cruise?
Yeah, you could say that for sure, definitely.
Okay. So, you know, you would have seen staff with gloves, maybe PPE on at times. Did that worry you at all, or are you used to that now with everything that we've been
through? Well, it didn't worry me. I thought it was normal procedure, but a lady did tell me a couple of mornings before we heard, you know, there must be something going on. They're not telling us this is not normal where the staff is serving us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the restaurant where you can pop in any time for something to eat. And they were there with all their gloves and not allowing us to help ourselves. So she was right. It was another day before we heard there was something going on.
Okay, but you're pretty cool about it. You're going to go on your day trips today. You're not overly worried.
No, sure. I'm nearly 80. If I die, I die.
Eileen, would you stop? I don't want to lose any listeners. You're listening to us. I hope you're listening to me in the cruise ship.
Anyway, I drink my brandy at night and that'll keep all infections away.
You're right. Hey, come here. We've just been speaking about drinking. But anyway, listen, if it works for you...
I don't drink all that much. If it works for you, it works for you. I don't drink brandy, really. I use it for medicinal purposes. And they took my blessed bottle off me when I was coming on board. I only had a little quarter with a little quarter of brandy in it in case I would be sick. But they took it off. And as my friends were saying, they should have been... taking people's temperature instead of taking the little brandy off me.
How long have you got left on the cruise, Eileen?
Oh, another week, 9 days, a week tomorrow.
And are you travelling with other people from Guidor? It's not a coincidence. That are you part of a travelling group?
I travel alone. I just happen to meet them on the cruise.
What an amazing woman.
I didn't know.
No bother. So you just headed to Belfast on your own, hop on the cruise, and away you go.
No, I make sure I'm with a good company, and I'm with the good company, John McGinley's Tours.
Brilliant.
They organise everything for me, and I just pay the money and off I go.
Happy days. Okay. Well, listen, Eileen, I'm glad to hear you're in such fine fettle. Enjoy the rest of your cruise. What a coincidence that you should end up with quite a number of people from Donegal. But I suppose if John McGinley's involved, it's not so big a coincidence at all. But listen, enjoy the trip.
I will.
Slán, Eileen.
I'm looking forward to going to Santiago, where, you know, visiting St. James Church. That was one of the main reasons I went on this cruise.
Oh, wow. What a thing to look forward to. Okay, well, Eileen, enjoy that and the rest of your activities. That's a regular listener to this show, Eileen. So, again, you know, even with the other cruise ship with the rat virus, as the Sky News and all are calling it, you know, there is a fascination with anything that seems to happen on a cruise ship. I don't know why that is, but it seems to get amplified way beyond if it happened in any other setting. It's just a sexy story when it's on a cruise ship. That seems to be the case. But in this case, just to be very clear, and I don't want to discourage anyone from cruising because I don't want to fall foul of the sort of media hype, but 1,700 people on that cruise with Eileen, mostly British and Irish. One passenger has died from a suspected outbreak of norovirus. So that elderly gentleman, it's not quite clear how he died. And they're all back to normal now. And initial tests didn't actually indeed find norovirus. It ruled it out, in fact, but further tests are underway. But Eileen, not to worry, and she's right. If she dies, she dies, she said, which is, I suppose, that's how she lives. That's the rules that she lives by. Okay. Right. Again, you know, but I think there probably is going to be great value on cruises because people get very influenced by this scaremongering. I mean, I'm sure Donald would tell us. I am sure there's probably hundreds of thousands of people currently on the sea in cruise ships all around the world. So this is affecting a tiny, tiny minority. The norovirus is there's not much to that story, but even the other cruise ship in the wider scale of that industry really is nothing. But as I say, for some reason, the media carried as frontline headline news because obviously we enjoy the stories or else it wouldn't be there. I'm joined on the programme now by Shannon O'Casteen, who's an Irish-speaking citizen and wants to speak, I suppose, generally about the language, its use or lack thereof. Good morning to you, Shannon.
Good morning. Yeah, the way you pronounce it there, that's how Ulster people pronounce my name. In the South, they pronounce it very much like Shannon, but I know in Ulster Irish, it's pronounced Shannon. And my family name is O'Cushneen. It's from the Gaeltacht in Waterford.
Okay, lovely stuff. Right, now, what are you speaking out about the Irish language, its use or lack thereof, Shannon? It's obviously something you're very passionate about.
I am, yeah, and it's a complicated story, but I'll give you some good stuff first and then we'll focus on the more negative stuff. Like, so I started school in a Gael school in Leighman Vradon, Leixlip in County Kildare in 1985. And if you had told somebody in 1985 that in 40 years' time we would have a British ambassador to Ireland who speaks Irish, that we'd have Irish language films getting Oscar nominations, we'd have Irish actors thanking Hollywood, Oscar Elga, like Cillian Murphy and Jesse Buckley, that we'd have rap music in Irish, that we'd have Irish as an official language of the European Union, that we'd have German supermarkets like Lidl putting up Irish signs all over their supermarkets, that we'd have machines in McDonald's restaurants where you can order your Big Macs and chips and McFlurries, Oscar Elga. People would have said, you're loopers. There's no way that's going to happen. But this is all the stuff that's happening. And there's so much exciting stuff happening in the Irish language at the moment. Like, never before in history have so many people been literate in the Irish language. Never before has there been so much broadcasting in Irish. Never before has there been so much advertising done in Irish. Never before have there been so many books been published in Irish. So there's so much stuff happening and it's really exciting. And I'd love to be a child again because the amount of stuff that's available for children now that wasn't available when I started school 40 years ago, it's incredible. So I'm very optimistic and excited about what's happening in Irish.
Yeah, and that is exciting and that's all around the edges. But when you get down to the core of the country, the constitution, the laws of this land, they're the laggards, arguably.
Yeah, this is where we're going to have to go into the more negative stuff, unfortunately. And it's sad. So I'll explain my situation. It's a bit like a hat trick in soccer. And if people don't know what a hat trick in football is, it's when a player scores 3 goals in the one game. And unfortunately, this is a situation I've ended up in. So I used to work for the Food Safety Authority of Ireland. And I noticed there was problems there with the Irish language. And I have a problem there's going to be a hearing in the Workplace Relations Commission, because my contention is I was basically kicked out of the FSI for blowing the whistle and saying this is a state agency without any competency in the Irish language. But in order to have a case in the Workplace Relations Commission, Oscuelga, you need people in the Workplace Relations Commission who can operate in the first official language. And the Workplace Relations Commission is a state legal body, but the Workplace Relations Commission can't organise a piss up in a brewery, and they've nobody in there who are fluent in the Irish language, and therefore they can't operate and provide a hearing and a system in the first official language, which, even though it's a state legal body. And then the third thing is there are a lot of laws that have not been translated into Irish. And it's not your job, and probably most of your listeners' jobs, to know this, but if people look at Article 25 of Bunrock na Héireann, the Irish Constitution, it says in black and white, if ever there's a conflict between an English language version and an Irish language version of a law or of an article in the Constitution, it's the Irish language version that prevails. And the people of Ireland voted for that in 1937. But just this week, the main translator in the Oireachtas, he said 50% of the laws haven't been translated into Irish.
So they're incomplete.
So it's like a total disaster. And it's going to cause a legal problem. And this is why I wanted to come onto this station today, talk about this, because Donegal is a Gaeltacht county. So this would be very pertinent to a lot of your listeners, probably, that if anybody, an Irish speaker in Donegal or any other part of Ireland, wanted to seek justice in the first official language of Ireland, the Irish language, they're going to face problems because the systems are not in place.
They are. And I mean, if the truth be told too, Shannon, and you know, it sounds to me like you want to engage with the system in good faith. That what you're talking of also has also been exploited to buy time or kick cases down the road.
No, I get that. But I'll tell you my family background and it'll become clear. Now, excuse my language, that I'm not acting the bollocks, because, you know, somebody might be saying, oh, this fella's just trying to be awkward and just kind of cause trouble or maybe try and delay stuff. So my dad is from the Gaeltacht in Waterford. I've got Irish-speaking first cousins in Waterford, in the Gaeltacht. We were all educated in Gaelscoileanna's in North Kildare. All my family, we have Irish names. My sister, she lives in the Gaeltacht in Connemara. She's the director of TG Carr. My two older sisters, they have degrees in Irish. I have a diploma in Irish. So if anybody wants to look at my family, they'll be able to see this isn't just somebody messing around here. This is somebody with strong connections to the Gaeltacht, educated through Irish. This isn't just for a joke. This is real. And there's kind of a moral problem, not only a legal problem. So the state wants all of its citizens to go to school and learn Irish. And it's kind of odd to know this, but Irish is the only compulsory subject in school. English and maths are not compulsory subjects, but they're kind of treated like compulsory subjects. But by law, Irish is the only compulsory subject. So here's the problem. Why is it that the people who did exactly what the state wanted them to do, which was to go to school, learn Irish, the only compulsory subject, and do state exams in two state exams at Junior Cert and Leaving Cert, and then the state says Irish is the first official language. There's an official language act. Irish is an official language of the European Union. And then everything has been set up so that the people who didn't succeed in learning Irish have it easy. But the people who did succeed in learning Irish and did exactly what the state wanted, they have the problems. Mm. And the big
I get you. Were you offered an interpreter to, which I, for me in itself would be a problem because, you know, language is open to interpretation, not just literally, but also in terms of and we've seen that actually, ironically, in this country, cases have been thrown out because interpreters were used, but it was for languages that were neither Irish or English. So it is a murky area. Yeah. How does this process? I presume you prefer not to use a translator, and why would you need to in your own country? One would ask. But how does this progress then? If you insist on continuing Oscuelga?
So, this is the thing, right? And trust me, it's stuff that I'd prefer not to be doing, but I'm actually stuck with no option but to do it. So, like as I said, I'm fluent in Irish. I was educated through Irish. It's a big part of my family background. And the state says Irish is the first official language. So therefore, I'm going to use my constitutional rights to be able to use the official languages in a legal process. And that's laid down in law. That's laid down in the Constitution and in the Official Languages Act. So that should be obvious and easy. But then why doesn't a state body like the Workplace Relations Commission have the systems in place? So in January this year, and again, a radio interview is not the best format for this, but I'll explain it as best I can. In January this year, there was kind of a hearing. It would be an insult to intelligence to really call it a hearing because nothing actually happened. But I've been promised last year by email that a person with fluent Irish would be the chairperson of this hearing. And then everything I thought would be ready. So we were all prepared. And then this one man walked in and said, oh, the person who was going to do this isn't available. I'm going to do it, but I don't have good enough Irish. So then we had this farcical situation where there was an interpreter who hadn't been prepared by the Workplace Relations Commission. And he said to us beforehand, he's going to struggle with the legal terms because he had no experience of legal matters. It was a farcical situation where the interpreter was interpreting from English into Irish for me, when the whole point of it was that there would be a person with fluent Irish in charge of the hearing, and the interpreter would be for anybody who didn't have Irish. And also, like, I submitted all my documents and the thing and in Irish, but the Workplace Relations Commission, they hadn't prepared anything, and they hadn't prepared and shared the documents. And I suspect the reason why they didn't have anything prepared is because they have nobody in there who can read high-level legal documents in Irish. And this is why they hadn't prepared and shared them. So I don't understand why the Workplace Relations Commission even scheduled.
I presume, though, and I must move on because of time, but I presume you want to get to the bottom of this. Are you prepared to cede any ground to have the WRC hearing in English, but actually then be able to make all the points that you wish to make to defend yourself in your own...
No, the whole point is that there's systemic failures in all sorts of state bodies in Irish. And like I told you, at the start, there's really good, exciting stuff happening in Irish. But then why is it like the Food Safety Authority of Ireland, which is a state law enforcement authority, it had zero competency in Irish. The WRC, a state legal body, they've nobody in there talking Irish. And then you've got the third problem, 50% of the laws of the state have never been published in Irish. And that causes a legal problem for me. And I've been trying to ring the bell about this, going ding, 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 this train is coming and we're going to have a crash whenever we have this hearing, because it's just basically institutional.
Are you not constitutionally protected, though, for those laws before they can be used for or against that they actually should be also translated into Irish, though? I mean, because if it seems to be that's your constitutional right. So if you cannot contest the Irish versions of the English laws, then surely your constitutional rights are being encroached upon, no?
Well, this is the thing. Like, there's not even a sentence of two of the laws that I've been referencing in my hearing, which is the protected disclosures. It's basically a whistleblowing law.
Yeah.
None of that hasn't been published in Irish. So therefore, if an adjudicator wants to run a proper hearing and they go, right, we're going to do this in Irish, but then how does he or she look at the law when the law has never been published? Not even a sentence of it. Yeah. So this is what I'm trying to highlight.
Very complicated.
So,
like,
there's a lot of problems here. This should have been done decades ago. Okay. And it's basically just institutional laziness that stuff hasn't been dealt with, but it's going to cause legal problems for the state and a lot of embarrassment for the state.
Right, okay. Listen, thank you, Shannon O'Coshin. Yeah. It's been nice speaking to you. Look after yourself. Okay.
Business Matters is proudly sponsored by Prince of Plays Frosses. With 21 years in business, Prince of Plays provides managed print solutions with local support and remote ink monitoring, saving your business time and money. Prince of Plays, your local printer and photocopier company.
How's your computer, Chris? Are you ready to go, or do you want me to do some
comments?
All is
good. Really? All is good.
Those darned Windows is updating. One thing I don't like about that is you can never trust the percentage. Do you know, like, something's loading? So, it either flies up to 98 and then just sits there for half an hour, or it sits at 5% for ages and then just boom, up to 100. Yeah. I really wish these companies would make their percentage bars more reliable. Right, okay, now, recruitment, finding good staff. You're talking of difficulties in that space.
Yeah, many employers finding it hard not just to get staff, and then keeping them is another matter, because it can be costly, not good for your business if you bring in people and then they move on within a few months. So there's an interesting event coming up. Letterkenny Chamber is hosting it. It's in the CoLab in Letterkenny. It's taking place next Wednesday morning. And Dr. Oran Darty, who is an an expert in the future of work. Well, he's having a workshop. He'll be looking at what drives staff turnover, the long-term retention plans that you can put in place, little changes that can improve employees' whole work experience.
Of course, and recognise your staff. I think some companies are afraid to, from people I speak to, you know, they're afraid to actually recognise good staff. In case they're like, oh, if I say they're doing well, they're going to come looking at me for a pay rise, or they're going to get too big for their boots or what have you. And then they'd be surprised then when all of a sudden they get a knock on the office door and saying, you know what, I'm not being treated the way I should be treated, and I'm out. And I'm sure that will form part of that conversation, because some good companies do recognise that.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a whole skill set in getting that balance right. Small things, it can be little motivational factors, there can be team bonding, all sorts of things. Early warning signs, that's another issue he's going to look out for. And, you know, you've touched on it there. So if you see a disgruntled employee, maybe there's something going on. Yeah,
yeah, and disgruntled, I know it's a word you use, but often it's not. It's just like, you know, genuine sense of a lack of respect or whatever it might be. There's another event in this space, isn't there, on the same day, actually, but it's a separate event altogether, right?
A separate event altogether. It's a live webinar. It's taking place next Wednesday from 10:30. You can go on to the Inishowen and Innovation. We'll have the links there for it. There are going to be a number of people from the HR team directors up in Dublin. They're going to be doing this webinar, and it's essentially about ways to track and manage employee leave during the summer. It's all about how you deal with that summer period when people are away on holidays. Maybe you're bringing in staff on a temporary basis. Again, this can be a big headache, and in an area that particularly here in Donegal, where you have a lot of seasonal employment, hotels, restaurants, and, you know, you can have this sudden turnover of staff. So it's something to be on top of. So that webinar, it will be online. As I say, if you go to Inishowen Innovation, you can register there for that.
Okay, those two events on May 20th. The Donegal Women in Business Network are hosting an event tomorrow, actually.
Yeah, lots happening. This is at the Regional Cultural Centre in Letterkenny from 2 to 6. There will be a number of speakers, including Tara Prendergast, founder of the Biscuit Factory. She's the keynote speaker. She'll be talking about all her experiences and about building a sustainable, creative business. There will be a writer and workshop facilitator. That's Isla McGuckin. A number of people there. There will be. It's all about looking at networking, and there will be an insight into pricing, growth, visibility, resilience, alongside another popular event being promoted by the Donegal Women in Business Network.
Yeah, we often talk about farming, no succession plans in the farming sector, and organisations have had big events locally to try and get people to start having that conversation or put something in place. But it's not just farming. It goes beyond that.
Indeed. Now, IFAC, which is an accountancy, tax and business advisory firm, they have done a survey of businesses, and they found that 6 in 10 of family businesses have no succession plan in place. So if the owner suddenly drops dead or something happens and he gets seriously ill, it can throw up all sorts of problems, as you've touched on, Greg, there. You know, the same with the farming community. Never too early to look at putting
plans
in place.
But it is also complicated, because you could have multiple siblings. You could have this idea that you're going to live forever. But the truth is, life comes at you very quickly. That is not the case, and you do need to have something in situ there.
Yes. Watch the series Succession to get an idea.
I must restart that, actually, because it's concluded now, but I missed the last series, but I'm going to start that from the beginning again, because I can't remember much about it. Right, you've got a big guest on the show, as always, this week on the podcast. Chris, who is
it? Yes, speaking with Andrea McBride, who's head of the Tata Consultancy Services Global Delivery Centre here in Letterkenny. It recently won a number of awards, including the Diversity, Inclusion and Workplace Culture Award that was held up in Dublin. And she's been telling me about not just this award, but also the success of the company. It's over 50 major customers. And earlier, last year, it was awarded the contract to develop the Irish government's the Auto Enrollment Pension Scheme, which is known as My Future Fund. So that's a big 15-year contract, and that's leading to jobs here in Letterkenny. And Greg, you know, it's hard to believe this is a company that has 650,000 people worldwide. It's absolutely
massive, isn't it?
And she speaks about the current recruitment drive in this clip here.
Right.
We now are going to be hiring over 100 roles for two big financial services clients in the UK. So looking to hire 40 in June, 30 in July and 30 in August for those two clients alone. We have around 200 open roles now currently, which is exciting. Cloud, cyber, software engineering, IT help desk, contact centre, etc. The capabilities that we've really concentrated on building out have been those high-end tech capabilities as well. We have about 65 cloud engineers here working on really high-end projects across the world. We have one of the biggest cyber capabilities in Ireland with 175 cyber folks right across the spectrum there. And digital marketing is another big capability for us, working around the world for different companies. And more recently, we're trying to grow now our actuarial talent.
Yeah, interesting to see that it continues to grow, Chris.
Absolutely, a great success story. Also this week, just to mention, I've been speaking with Adam Emerson of Gander Ireland, which helps retailers to turn reduced to clear food into sales. It's done in real time. It goes online, and he's been working with the Maple Retail Group, which has stores all over the county, and that has certainly proved to be very successful. So it's all about moving stock, creating extra profit, and it's AI-backed and a very interesting concept.
Yeah. It is, because I do go into shops, this is unrelated to that, but you go into shops and there's like, you know, it seems like 30 products that have an expiry date of tomorrow, and you wonder, are these all going to sell? Because everyone's reaching into the back to get the next day's ones. All right, Chris, the podcast is available today, so you can listen in the playback section of our website. You can actually even download it if that suits you better. And it's also being exported then to Spotify and also iTunes as well. And if you want to listen to it live, Chris, scheduled, you know what I mean?
Yes, on Sunday after the 6 o'clock news on the wireless.
On DL Wireless. All right, Chris, thanks very much indeed. I do appreciate your time there. Right, do I have time for comments? Not really. The latest round of listenership figures are being released today at 12 noon. We'll talk about them a little bit tomorrow, but just in advance of them being released, I suspect things are going to look pretty decent for us, and just want to thank you all for that, for the station, but also for this show specifically. And I mention that because this is the show that you listen to right now. We'll have more on that on our socials, and we'll chat about that a little bit more tomorrow, because it is very much appreciated. We appreciate every single one of you listening, and we appreciate you giving us the opportunity to work on some big issues and some little issues on your behalf as well, and also to come in and chat about your life and try and spread information and everything else that we do in between. We'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Looking forward to it already.